Hey, you're not going to bed yet, are you? That's right. It's time for TV Good, Sleep Bad.
TV is awesome! TV is awesome! TV is awesome!
Now, here are your hosts, Daniel Lackey and Elwood Jones.
Hello, and welcome to another edition of TV Good Sleep Bad. I am your host, as always, Elwood Jones of From the Depths of DVD Hell. And joining me in the basement is my partner in crime and co-host, Mr. Daniel Lackey.
I just flew in from Kashyyyk for the Life Day celebration, and boy, are my arms tired.
If you haven't guessed already, this is our Christmas special, and today we are going to be looking at Emmett Otter's Jug Band Christmas, as well as everyone's favourite holiday viewing, and which Glee boldly proclaimed the greatest Star Wars moment of all time. We are going to be looking at the Star Wars Holiday Special. Before we obviously get into that, though, we're going to start the show, as always, by asking what you've been watching. So, obviously, Lucky, this is the Christmas season, time for feasting and catching up on general Christmas cheese. What's obviously been holding your attention?
Well, not a whole lot, actually, for the most part, because I haven't been able to do much watching because of other commitments in my life. Like, work commitments always tend to get a little bit hairy just before mid-December.
Yeah.
So mostly what I've... what I've done is just like the Survivor finale, last few episodes of the season Survivor, turned out really, really good. Really, just a lot of surprising stuff. A lot of great tribal councils, one after the other. Mostly happy with the winner. Not 100% happy, but mostly happy with the winner. And we've got some, one of the things we got, and I know you mentioned this on our last episode, but we started with the promo when we were watching Survivor. They started with the promos for Hunted.
Okay.
So I've actually been able to see what Hunted is going to look like a little bit. And that actually looks, that's going to be, I think, one of my next, my must watches of the coming year. Okay. But other than that, it's just been a bunch of SVU reruns.
We're still obviously waiting for it to come back off its mid-season break, which with SVU, it always seems to like have these huge breaks between partway through seasons, and it's so frustrating.
Yeah.
Even though the show's perhaps not as good as it was in its early years, and especially since a lot of key characters left, and especially more so since Olivia became the chief, I struggle to get into it more than I used to. Before, it used to be quite good when you obviously had the Benson and Stabler duo, and you had like
right,
Munch.
And you had Munch, and then you had Cragen. You had Cragen as the sergeant or the lieutenant or the one, the captain.
Yeah.
I can never keep these ranks straight in my head, but yeah, I mean, to me these days it's more of a sort of like visual comfort food. I do like the current group with I only know the actors' names for the most part, but like Peter Scannavino,
yeah.
Kelly Giddish, Raul Esparza. I think they make a good crew all together. But you know, there's the sort of interplay that Mariska Hargitay and Chris Maloney had in the old days. That's just sort of a one of a kind thing. You're not going to get that back. But I mean, for the most part, I think the stories are pretty good. It's not as, you know, again, it's not as perhaps good as it was in prime, but I think I think it's still kind of like a, like I said, comfort food.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, you're not going to walk away from it. You know, I know I'm going to be generally entertained for an hour and not walk away from it wanting to beat my head against a wall. So.
And obviously I have to ask with Hunted, is this the British version or is there an American version that I've missed?
It's an American version.
Oh, this is even more exciting then, because obviously,
yeah,
with America, it's a lot bigger sort of place. I'm wondering, are they confined to a state or can they basically go anywhere in America? Because in the British version, you can't take a plane or you can't take a boat.
Right.
But you can go basically anywhere from Cornwall up to Scotland. So
right.
There's still a lot of territory you can cover, but obviously with America, I mean, that's a huge playing field. So I was very curious to know how they would.
From the promos, I can't tell. And it looks like they're going, I haven't seen the British version, so I can't tell, but they're, CBS is advertising this as a quote unquote reality thriller. They're really like ratcheting. They look like they're really focusing on like the desperation and the paranoia aspects.
Yeah.
Of the concept. I don't know, like I said, I don't know what the British version was like. I don't know how the ads pitched it to the audience in Britain, but here if this were a fictional show, you know, there would be no way I would not be on that, you know? And I mean, the reality show, it actually makes it a little bit, I'm not a huge reality TV fan, but this is one of those concepts that I just find, okay, how would this play out in real life?
Yeah. I mean, I can only obviously speak for the British version, but it makes you realize how much of a surveillance state Britain is. The fact that when they're basically trying to escape, like, or they're going to a city, like, a number plate can be scanned from any number of cameras along a motorway. You can be, like, caught on CCTV from, like, going to a cash point or just going down the high street. There's all these, like, things you never sort of realized. And at the same time, they have the ability to put out, like wanted sort of posters, so they can appeal to information to the general public, and they appeal to people's base nature, so money, basically.
Yeah.
By offering cash reports, it's amazing what people's loyalties would suddenly shift on you.
And yeah.
Just how different people approach the game. In the second season we had this guy, and he's like basically a homemaker, and he was kind of like this guy we thought he'd be like captured the first week. He's kind of like, seems a little simple, and he basically turned into like this gray man for them, and he outlasted everyone. And I kind of like wanted it to be that he was like, turns out that he's got all this military training and all these like skills and stuff. So he's kind of like Liam Neeson in Taken, but he's been like living this simple life, and like it's now just basically triggered him, and he's just like gone rogue, and they just haven't realized what exactly they've got themselves into.
He's got some super freaky Treadstone programming, like he was from a Bourne movie, Bourne movie, and he's just living like in the middle of, you know, he's just living in like the English countryside. They activate him, and it's like, you know, all of a sudden he knows kung fu and all that. I mean, a lot of it, I know that they've been putting CCTV cameras and ATMs cash points for a long time. And even, you know, even when I visited Britain in 2004, that was one of the things they were talking about up front is, you know, you're going to have to kind of get used to, like, if you're in London or if you're in a city, but particularly London, cameras everywhere outside.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I saw those things everywhere.
Oh, yeah. It's very much all like 1984. This is a Big Brother state, or a bad mother, as 2000 AD called it. It's staggering the amount of times you will be captured on camera throughout the day. And a lot of the time you don't realize it. You obviously see like CCTV cameras about, but it's the cameras you don't see that is the surprising part.
And I would even think the more CCTV, even the more obvious ones you see, you know, the more you see them, if you're used to living with them, you know, for like 5-10 years, they become like an ambient aspect of your environment. Your mind edits them out the way that you don't notice lampposts and other things.
Yeah, exactly. It's just another part of the landscape now. Bizarro, we obviously have all these sorts of survival shows come up. I mean, obviously, since the last show, we've had the press release for the Russian game show, Game to Winter. And this one's got a lot of hype in the UK press, who basically haven't understood how the Russian hype machine works for anything they promote. And basically, with Game to Winter, they're putting these contestants out in, like, the Siberian wilderness, and they have to survive. I believe it's for like 6 months. And the basically the brief that's been given is that each contestant gives consent that they could be maimed, even killed. There's 2,000 cameras, 900 hectares, and 30 lives. Everything is allowed: fighting, alcohol, murder, rape, smoking, and everything. I love the fact they put smoking after rape.
Yes.
It's like that's escalating through, but yeah, smoking's worse than rape.
That's the kind of society and culture we live in now, though, you know, where it's, you can do what you want, you know, bestiality, rape, murder, you know, incest, just don't smoke a cigarette while you're doing it.
Exactly. So yeah, while the Independent, who obviously released this story, they focus on the whole, oh, there's going to be like murder and rape and stuff. But the actual brief says that if anyone does commit like murder or rape or commits a crime, there are police on site who will arrest them. So they're still obviously under state power.
So right.
It's not like a battle royale. It's not like the Running Man. They're not just putting this thing and it's a free for all.
Right. But
the way the Russian hype machine loves to do things is to blow it up into like the most extreme way possible.
Right.
Because they don't really do subtlety. It's kind of like how America tends to present the news, just from my own personal experiences, where I think it's it was like a fox attacks a man on Ride on Mower, and they described it as, it was a scene from a horror movie. I'm thinking, what horror movie does a fox attack someone on a Ride on Mower?
Well, I would say you obviously don't watch many horror films, but you do. So, I mean, it would be a somewhat sarcastic horror film. It would be like The Night of the Lepus, but with foxes. But no, it's the American news media. It's hilarious like that. You know, I mean, well, it's hilarious if you're an observer and you realize what's going on. It's not hilarious if you don't understand what they're doing. Because literally, I think it was somewhere in the mid-2000s where there were like a couple shark attacks in Florida. And they were literally, the news media was literally blowing it up to this sort of, like this whole epidemic, like sharks were on a rampage and just about to eat all of Florida. I mean, that's the way it sounded. It was like, why are all these sharks, you know, attacking people? And it's like three attacks.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, this is not a freaking epidemic. But, you know, that's, you know, I've always asserted that that's what we get for not having a publicly funded, we do have PBS here, but it like, not having like a significantly large publicly funded media outlet, you know, where all of news is a commercial concern.
Yeah.
You know, everything that goes on in a television broadcast has to be able to make money for advertisers. And that's my big problem. I do not watch cable news. I don't care if it agrees with me or not. You know, yes, I avoid Fox News. I am liberal. I avoid Fox News like that. But I even ignore the ones that are supposedly the biases more towards my own bias, because I just think the whole model is just bad for news. It's literally ruining the media in America. You know, the idea that it has to make the money. Not that there aren't problems with publicly funded media as well, but I don't know. I guess there's a reason they're not having me control the media in this country, and not just because everything would look like either Hannibal or Better Call Saul.
I mean, it's funny you should obviously mention about Great White attacks, because every summer they have this panic about Great Whites in Cornwall.
Uh-huh.
Cornwall, for those not up to speed on the geography, if you put your finger on the bottom of England, you're in Cornwall. And
yeah.
In the summer, we have the migration of the Baskin sharks, which are these big, big, beautiful sharks, and they feed on plankton, same as whale sharks. But because everyone's seen Jaws, they see these big ominous silhouettes, and it's sort of like the great whites are coming. And because some joker always submits their holiday snaps from like South Africa or something about this great white. It's always like great white spotted off the coast of Cornwall. And for 6 years, we've had great white supposedly spotted off the coast of Cornwall.
Beautiful.
It's like part of the summer ritual now. You're just waiting for the great white scandal to come up in for Cornwall. So,
I mean, I don't hear a whole lot. I mean, the other thing I mainly know Cornwall for is that's where Aphex Twin is from. Yeah. So Aphex Twin having gone into hiding for like 15 years, I guess if you're in Cornwall, you have to find something to do.
It's not surprising that Aphex Twin is based down in Cornwall. I see for Cornwall, Devon.
Yeah, I think it's Devon.
Oh, I personally say the same, but you know, that's just going to get a lot of people upset. Because they're very adamant that the two are different, even though their borders cross over. But we won't go into that. It's like saying that Oldham and Manchester are the same thing, which they're obviously not.
No.
But yes, Cornwall, the land of cream teas and pasties. But great white panic scandals. So.
It's kind of a dead season on television right now, because it's not just that SVU's on hiatus. Everything's on hiatus for Christmas. Yeah. There's going to be very little new programming on the broadcast networks over here until like early to mid January.
Okay. I mean,
it's a typical thing on American broadcast television. And even, you know, one of the things you'll generally notice is that even the cable networks that have, where they tend to go for the lower episode orders. I mean, the thing is that the model for, you know, the model seems to be, from what I've seen for British television, is that you have these lower episode orders anywhere from like, you know, 6 to 13. And most of them are in production, and in many cases I hear about a show like it's a British show, like it's already actually been produced more or less by the time it airs. And you can't really do something with the traditional American order of like 22 to 24 episodes.
No.
So it is really like everything's kind of in flux at the same time. But this is the typical thing is that generally speaking, there's really, you know, no new episodes of anything American broadcast in December until like early January. And even the cable shows, they will generally be either done by December or they won't premiere their episodes in December. They'll wait till January.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, just on the subject of delays, though, Westworld came to the end of its first season the last couple of weeks now. And we're currently looking at 2018 before we get season two.
Yeah, that's another thing I think that's going to kind of happen with these sorts of things. And that's becoming more common. Doctor Who, for example, there was no new Doctor Who season this year. They haven't announced a new date. It will probably be April. The only new Doctor Who we'll be getting this year is the Christmas special.
Yeah.
This year's Christmas special, which will inexplicably feature the return of Matt Lucas, which really makes me wonder. I don't know anybody who likes that character, so I'm not entirely sure. I'm not entirely sure what kind of relationship Stephen Moffat and Matt Lucas have. But also, like, Fargo took the year off. Fargo will not be debuting its third season until this year. Until 2017. And I think that's going to be a bit more common. I think, amongst other things, Westworld is an HBO show, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think part of it may very well be not just, because I know it's also expensive and they need to kind of like get, I mean, you have people who are like genuine stars on that show. That's Anthony Hopkins is on Westworld, and I think a couple of other people, Jeffrey, I haven't seen it yet, but I know a little bit about it. I've been very good at avoiding the spoilers.
Yeah.
But like, I know like some other people who are basically, you know, jobbing actors like Evan Rachel Wood and Jeffrey Wright are on it. And you always, you know, it's always nice to give them time to go off and do a movie. I think that's part of it. And I think also HBO being the home of Game of Thrones may want to try to give dedicate as much of it, a little bit more resources to the final couple chunks of Game of Thrones before that dies year after next.
Yeah. I think, Westworld has been an incredible opening season. Certainly this gap is going to give us a chance for people to catch up and discover this first season, because it was a bit of a weighty chunk. And my only concern is the fact that you've got both Ed Harris and Anthony Hopkins, as you mentioned already, both older actors. And I'm very concerned that one of them's going to cop it the way that 2016 went, that we're going to lose one of them before we obviously get into the 2018 series.
Right.
But certainly Ed Harris has been, he's been dropping hints, and he's been saying that everyone's very excited about the season ahead because they've obviously worked out what direction they're going to go. I don't think they finalized any sort of scripts, but they've got an outline for the season ahead. Certainly where it ended the season, I was very happy with it. And it just made it all the more frustrating, the fact I have to wait a whole year to have it. With Fargo, it's a little bit different because it's self-contained stories within each season. So it's not like you're left on a cliffhanger as such. You've had your story.
Yeah.
And it's now it's kind of like waiting for a new book by an author. So, I mean, it gives me a chance at least to catch up with season two, which I still have to watch. I mean, I watched season one and I enjoyed it enough, but everyone said that season two was a lot better.
Season two, I don't know where I stand really ranking the two seasons beside each other. Actually, I'm a bit surprised to find that how many people seem to prefer season two of Fargo to season one, because at the time, season two seemed to be really kind of getting a lot of the episodes were getting a lot of reactions like, okay, Noah, this is nice, but where is this going? And then towards the end of the season, holy crap, what the fuck was that? And not necessarily in the good, not necessarily in the kind of like the good, the Red Wedding, the Bastards way, but like more of a like, what was he thinking way. I enjoyed season two of Fargo. I enjoyed it a lot. But it didn't seem that other people really did enjoy it as much as I did.
Yeah.
So it could be, I don't know, it could be one of those things where people, it's, you know, having been, you know, a year in the past, now people are reconsidering it and thinking about it, or maybe you're just listening to different people than I am. I don't know.
It's certainly one of those things, but certainly this year being the old alternate Christmas season, for anyone who obviously reads my blog from the Depths of TV Hell, we know that being a critic who focuses on cult, foreign, and obscure cinema, I don't get into the Halloween season the way a lot of the cult and genre bloggers do. The Halloween is normally the big holiday for genre bloggers, and because I look at horror movies all year round, I don't tend to really care for Halloween, because I can watch horror any time of year. Probably the same for yourself, Lackey. It's why Christmas, especially from the start of December, is sort of like my go time. It's like my busy time of year, because I love alternate Christmas movies. So things like Silent Night, Deadly Night, Christmas Evil, Don't Open Till Christmas, and these sort of alternate takes on Christmas. And every year I try to cram in as many of these as I can, but it always seems to be like one or two that suddenly come into vogue that you kind of miss. And this year was about trying to prioritize those. So one was obviously Emmett Otter's Jug Band Christmas, which we'll be talking about in a minute. The other one was Pee Wee Herman's Christmas Special. And over here in the UK, we never got Pee Wee's Playhouse. So this is my first time seeing the show. The only experience I have with Pee Wee Herman is through the Tim Burton film, like Pee Wee's Big Adventure and Pee Wee's Big Top. And I'll be damned if this special isn't so wholesome. It is like first of all, it's really entertaining, especially for a kid's show. It doesn't kind of dumb things down as a kid's show. It's very hyperactive, but it's never to the point where it's irritating. And the fact that he crams so much in, there's like this huge shopping list of like celebrity guests. You've got like the two, these two celebrity guests who are working in basically Pee Wee's sweatshop, where he's forcing them to make Christmas cards. There's this fantastic running joke where everyone keeps giving him fruit cake, and You even like touch on things such as like Hanukkah with the dinosaurs who live in the walls, who obviously are Jewish for some reason. I just really enjoyed this the Christmas special. I think it was, there's just something about it, and the fact that you have like Whoopi Goldberg randomly turn up, Cher randomly turns up, Grace Jones turns up and does like a disco rendition of Little Drummer Boy. It was kind of like having one good thing upon the next, like stacked up on each other. And just when you think it's going to topple, it ends. And it's like this like perfect self-contained hour of television.
Right.
And it makes me wonder why I haven't discovered it sooner. And kind of makes me want to go back and see other episodes of the show to see how it plays. But yeah, it was, I just love it. It opens with the Marine Choir, who then burst into a lovely dance routine because, you know, they're obviously the fabulous fighting force of the United States Marine Corps, I guess.
Yeah.
I don't know if they're actual Marines or not, but it's certainly interesting to see these Marines suddenly burst into a big song and dance number.
Oh, definitely.
I mean, were you a fan of
Pee-wee? The thing about Pee-wee is that Pee-wee is one of those things that they were... Pee-wee, if I recall correctly, was kind of like slightly after my time.
Yeah.
Like, I was maybe just a year or two older than I think the target audience for Pee-wee's Playhouse. If I'd been 2 or 3 years younger, that would have been another thing. But and Pee-wee Herman was an interesting sort of figure, if I remember correctly. Paul Rubens first kind of made a name for himself with the character, playing the character, like in things for like MTV promos. And in many ways, it's looking back at things, looking back at the 80s and early 90s, just the sheer number of like minor celebrities that got their start entirely, or even major celebrities that kind of got their start from just being in America, from just being in MTV promos. Just off the top of my head, I can think of, Pee-wee Herman. I mean, some that have gone on to do bigger things, like Dennis Leary was one. Then in sort of more flash of the pan ones, like Pauly Shore. And then ones that, you know, they were trying to get to do... They were trying to get more famous, but it never really worked out, like Randy the Redwoods or Yahoo Serious. And I think really Dennis Leary and Pee-wee Herman were the ones that really, I think, kind of went the furthest from the MTV promos. So I was familiar with him. I was aware of Pee-wee Herman for at least, I want to say, a year or two before the Playhouse started and before the movies came out. So that's not something, like I said, that's not something I watched. I was maybe just a year or two to outside the target audience. But like I said, I know a lot of people that are even as the age gap is as small as 3 or 4 years. And they are just gaga over, you know, they have very, very fond memories of Pee-wee's Playhouse.
Oh, definitely. I think it's this,
and in retrospect, it is regarded in retrospect very, very warmly and highly over here.
I mean, he's this sort of cult figure from a lot of people's childhoods. It seemed the same as Jim Varney's Ernest character.
Yeah, Ernest is a Ernest. I don't associate him a lot of that time with that kind of group, although he really kind of was, because I didn't see him on MTV. He started out, Jim Varney, the Ernest, I want to say he started doing that in like, I want to say he was from Texas, and then he had become like a minor hit just doing stuff for like advertisements for, I don't remember what it was, like a used car dealership
or something like that.
It was some sort of like, you know, working class, you know, small business, and it just kind of exploded from there.
Yeah, it's... I mean, there was a one point where Jim Varney held the record for most visits for Make-A-Wish. And even when he was, like, dying of lung cancer, he basically fulfilled every last one of those requests for people to meet him, which is quite an achievement, really, for if you're, like, dying of lung cancer to still go out there and do promotion and be positive and, you know, be obviously have a sick dying kids and stuff, and still be this earnest character for them. And yeah, I mean, I remember him obviously as Ernest, and I remember him as Slinky Dog. So it's it was nice that when they did Toy Story 3, they didn't screw up Slinky Dog the same way that when Jim Henson died, they didn't screw up Kermit. It was
right.
These two very key characters that they could have easily screwed up if they didn't get the voices right. So, yeah, but no, Pee-wee's Playhouse was, that was just a, it's been a delight to this old current batch of like alternate Christmas fodder that I've sort of plowed through. I mean, I think this really kind of brings us on to the first of our selections here, because as I said, it's been mainly a TV, a film watching sort of season for myself. But on to the first of our selections. I mean, we're going to talk now about Emmett Otter's Jug Band Christmas. This was a selection chosen by yourself, Lackey. So, I mean,
it was.
What is it about Emmett Otter that made you obviously want to view it?
Emmett Otter was one of those things I had known about. I'd been aware of what it was for quite some time, but it's one of those things where in probably about the late, there's been kind of a resurgence in interest in the Muppets. You know, the Muppets were kind of like, kind of there in the background for a while, and then just for whatever reason, particularly in the late, a little bit more interest started building up in like the late 2000s, early 2010s. A lot of that obviously, you know, coming from the movie, the movies and stuff like that. But I had read an article, so I had been aware of Emmett Otter's Jug Band Christmas. I knew it was a Muppet thing. I read an, probably about 2009 or 2010, the AV Club did a series of articles on Christmas specials that were not like, I mean, we have like the big Christmas specials over here in America, you know, the two all-consuming ones that will everybody like, you know, bases their holiday viewing around how the Grinch Stole Christmas and Charlie Brown. Yeah. And then a few others like the Rankin and Bass, like the Frosty the Snowman and Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. And then a few kind of modern ones like, I guess the Garfield one is fairly highly regarded. So the AV Club was doing kind of like a series of articles on kind of ones that I don't know if I've necessarily seen alternative, but kind of fell through the cracks. And I happened to read their article on Emmett Otter, and I'm like, okay, this is interesting. I didn't really have a whole lot of context for it, but I thought I'll sit down and watch it this year. And I was, you know, charmed to bits, to be honest. This was produced in 1977 for HBO, of all things. And it's based on a short children's book by Russell Hoban, who was actually American. But by the time he wrote Emmett Otter, he had basically expatriated himself to London. And I guess most of the things he's written, the main thing that I think people associate him with is a big novel called Ridley Walker, I think is the name of it. And that's the other thing that kind of got me interested in Emmett Otter. It's like, oh, I didn't know Emmett Otter was written by the Ridley Walker guy. But it's basically, it's a very simple story. It's based on basically around the same premise as the old O. Henry's Fairy Gift of the Magi. That's the one with the young poor couple at Christmas, and they want to buy, each wants to buy the other an expensive Christmas present, a really nice expensive Christmas present. You know, so the husband hawks his you know, the husband hawks his pocket watch to you know, to buy his wife a hairbrush, and his wife has her hair cut, probably for a wig, and uses the money to buy her husband a chain for his pocket watch. You know, that kind of twist story. And this is basically the same concept. You know, basically it's anthropomorphic animals living, you know, somewhere out in the middle of the rural America. They live on the river. And Emmett Otter, you know, lives with his ma, and they're modest means. They get money by Emmett works odd jobs with his late father's tools, and his mother bakes pies and, you know, knits socks. And it's Christmas time, and they want to buy each other a musical instrument. So Emmett Otter gets an offer to join a, an old style jug band with a jug player, guy blowing on a jug, and a guy with a cigar banjo, and another guy scratching on a washboard. And they, you know, they want him to play the washtub bass, but in order to you know, make a bass out of their washtub, going to have to poke a hole in it and ruin it. And that's something that's kind of foreshadowed in one of the early and probably the catchiest songs in the whole special, which is about how wonderful life can be if you look on the bright side. That, you know, it doesn't, you might as well, I mean, if there's no hole in your washtub, you're on easy street. You might as well have money in your pocket, even if you don't, because life is good.
Yeah.
You know, so he has to poke a hole in his washtub to kind of enter this talent contest, you know, with a $50 prize. So he, you know, similarly, his mother, she wants to buy him a nice present. So she hawks his father's tools, late father's tools, in order to buy fabric so she can make a fancy dress when she goes out and sings at the talent contest. And then everything is kind of complicated by this arrival of these hooligans and no goodniks from another town, who kind of crash the talent show with by putting on a display of rock and roll music, very Alice Cooper-esque, which I think that's the thing that really kind of dates this to the 70s more than anything else, is that even at that point, loud, obnoxious, distorted rock music with electric guitars and Hammond organs was your go-to signifier for these people are shady dealers. But yeah, I mean, it has a happy ending, but for the most part, it's, you know, pretty simple. But I found it to be very charming in the way I think the best Muppet work under Jim Henson always was. It had that kind of, it's technically impressive from a technical standpoint with the puppetry. You do get to see different types of puppetry on display here, but it's all kind of in service to something that, you know, Jim Henson just had this sort of, I don't know how to put it, but there was a sort of just like this good naturedness, this good heartedness to the Muppets and to Jim Henson's work that always shines through. And Emmett Otter, I think is definitely a, And everything, as much as you're impressed by, oh, they can make the puppets do that, it's all in the service of this sort of heartwarming thing. And it's not heartwarming in a cheap way. It's not heartwarming in a way that doesn't mean anything. I mean, this is genuinely about people in tough times trying to figure out how they're going to make it through.
Oh, definitely.
There is a sort of level of bittersweetness there, but the emotion, it's all genuine, it's all earned, it's not cheap and manipulative. And part of the really, I think part of the secret weapon in this arsenal are the songs. As with the Muppet movie, the songs were written by Paul Williams. And you've got some really just wonderful sort of, I was surprised to find out that a couple of these songs weren't genuine old sort of like river Appalachian jug band songs. I mean, Paul Williams does a very good job of kind of replicating how that folk memory of what we in would think a song like that should sound like. So from there, I'm going to turn it over to you.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think you nailed it right there. This is really quite wholesome Christmas viewing. And it's a very simple story. I mean, this is Jim Henson really in the same sort of territory they would be sort of towards the end of his career with things such as like The Storyteller, even though this isn't going anywhere as dark as that. This is just the simple joy of telling as little story, and obviously using puppets to tell it. I mean, when this was originally released, it did feature an introduction by Kermit the Frog. However, when the rights to the Muppets were sold to Walt Disney Company in 2004, they basically hacked out the Kermit parts. So now it seems like this little offshoot, and kind of like got a feel of being like an experimental film for Henson. in the fact that you don't see any familiar Muppet characters. These are all original Muppets or puppets. I don't know what to really sort of classify these ones as, because they don't have the traditional sort of puppetry makeup of what we would classify as being like the Muppets or even like the Sesame Street characters or Fraggle Rock. But this was a special, which really, I would say last year was really in vogue. I mean, I heard it on both the Bonus Material podcast. They were raving about it. The Feminine Critique were talking about it. And it seemed like everyone suddenly wanted to talk about Emmett Otter's Jug Band Christmas. And this never made it over to the UK, as far as I'm aware. This was purely in the States. So it's taken me till now to actually see it. And I think once it gets going, because it starts off a little too saccharine for myself, you've obviously got Emmett and his mother, and they're going around and they're doing odd jobs, and the fact that nobody's paying them, so they're kind of hard done to. The fact that while they're hardworking people, the people of Riverbottom are kind of cheap and don't like paying them, because they've always got excuses why they can't pay them. And Emmett's mother is like so good natured that she's like really forgiving and like believes all their excuses and stuff. And she's got this really wholesome outlook, as you mentioned already. It's like, you know, as long as there's not a hole in the wash tub, you know, everything's going to work itself out. And obviously we end up in this situation where both of them are entering into the talent contest. Neither know that they're involved. And with the grand cash prize of $50, which apparently when this was released, it meant that you could either buy a piano or a guitar. So obviously $50 went a lot further back then than it does now.
Yeah, it was $50 was a princely sum in 77.
Certainly so. And it's, as you mentioned already, we've got the Nightmare Band, who are basically this team of villainous thugs who wouldn't look out. They're kind of like the Muppet version of the thugs from Mad Max. Because first time you're into-
I mean, Mad Max Beyond Riverbottom.
You cannot look at the opening scene where they're basically ransacking the music shop and they're like throwing the drunkard out and it's like, oh, they weren't meant to roll it. Why did they make it round? You cannot watch that opening scene and not have your mind throw back to the scene where the bikers roll into town in Mad Max 1.
Thank you. You've either ruined Mad Max or Emmett Otter for me forever, and I thank you for it.
And yeah, these so-called thugs, they're crawling around the little their cruiser, and later they turn up on snowmobiles.
Which, oh yeah,
so they're very well funded, and I love the fact they turn up, and obviously they're the Nightmare Band. So as you mentioned, they're sort of like the rock and roll aspect, the Alice Cooper representation here, and you know, spoiler alert, they win the competition. You think going into this, you know, they're going to get their comeuppance, they're not going to win the competition, and Emmett Otter's going to prevail and get some big turn of events that's going to mean that Emmett and his mother are all going to be supported. But no, Emmett and his mother both lose. There's a hole in the wash tub now. They're broke. And basically, at the end, Emmett and his mother come together and they combine their musical styles and manage to get a job singing in a restaurant. So,
One of the things, and I was a little bit concerned how this would play to non-American audiences, because this is you're dealing with a lot of really kind of like, at least what seemed to me to be American archetypes. This isn't like Americans. We tend to, I think, maybe romanticize poverty a little bit more in America than in American literature than Brits do. Whenever I think about how Britain kind of like portrays the poor in its literature, I always think of like Dickens.
Okay.
You know, whereas with America, it's like this idea of Emmett and Alice are this very fundamentally American archetype. They're fools. They're complete fools. They, and from what I understand, Hoban's original story plays this up a lot more than Henson actually dumbed this down, but de-emphasizes somewhat, although it is there. They're fools who let people take advantage of them because they are so good-natured. You know, early on, Their one character remarks, there goes two of the nicest people on the river, but they're so nice they are constantly letting people take advantage of them. If I recall correctly, I've never read Hoban's original story, but the River Bottom Nightmare Band winning the talent contest happened because of some sort of shenanigans that happened between them and the mayor. And the mayor is married to the woman at the beginning of the episode, the one who is complaining about the spot on her laundry and doesn't want to pay Alice the full amount.
Yeah.
You know, and that, like I said, the fool who is somehow very, you know, the romanticized fool who is good-natured and hardworking but easily taken advantage of, that's very American. And it's another very American thing is the ending. The Emmett Otter does not end with either of them winning the prize. It ends up with them getting a job. It ends up with them getting steady income. And I really, in many ways, I think that strikes me as a very American thing that, you know, particularly now where it's just not a one-time payment. And I mean, I'm not saying it's good or bad. I'm just saying it's the thing in our culture. And I may be sounding slightly condescending or whatever. I don't know. But it just really, with this watch, with watching it this time, it really kind of struck me what an American archetype that is.
I think, yes, well, it's obviously, you could obviously view it from that perspective. Certainly when looking at it, you've got undertones of Wind in the Willows running throughout this, which is certainly my main reference point, you know, the fact that both are set on the riverbank. At the same time, it's got that make-do attitude that we obviously saw in, like, the works of Enid Blyton. The idea that, you know, and perhaps in some, like, works of, like, Rodin, where you obviously have this attitude of, we may not have enough, but we make do. We don't dwell on what we don't have. Yes, the situation's not particularly great. We may be all sitting around in one bed and eating cabbage stew for three meals a day, but, you know, we've got our health and we've got each other and we're resourceful enough to get through life. And
now that I think about it, that you mentioned Dahl, yeah, I remember that particularly obviously from Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, but also from Danny, the Champion of the World, and I think to an extent, I think somewhat present, if I remember correctly, in Fantastic Mr. Fox as well.
I mean, Danny, Champion of the World, I say, would be another perfect example of that kind of spirit. I mean, that's a story based around poaching, which is a great thing when you're growing up as a kid to read a book about poaching, especially if you've grown up in the country like I was, where pheasants and that and are quite prolific and everywhere. So it was quite a fun story to have that relatable aspect to it. But no, I mean, I love the, well, I don't love all the music in this. I mean, some of it's a little too slow and a bit too shoegazy, but no, certainly the jug band numbers like Barbecue, I really enjoy. And I love the fact they played it twice, because I was kind of like, I really want to listen to that again. It's like, oh, wait, here it is again. So I was like, that's good. Obviously, with the cast here, we've got people like Frank Oz providing voice work, as well as Dave Goles and Jim Henson. So it's really sort of like those key Muppet players doing voice work and performance here. The bear in particular of the River Bottom Nightmare Band has got such an amazing voice, and he's kind of like a shrunken version of Bobo, which is kind of cool if Bobo was obviously evil, but there's just something very frightening about the way that bear holds itself, and the others are just basically minus loons and could be, I don't know, compared to like the weasels in Who Framed Roger Rabbit, they're just gibbering fools. And I love the fact that is it a catfish that they have?
The catfish. Yeah.
Who's got a built-in water tank into everything that they do, which is pretty cool. And the fact he spits water at people, which is really good. And he's called Popeye.
Yeah, yeah. And that's Popeye Catfish, and that's Dave Gills. And obviously, as Chuck the Bear, you can definitely tell Frank Oz's voice. That there's just, So that's in many ways to me like the kind of the prototypical or the archetypal Frank Oz performance. You can definitely hear how other characters kind of move from there.
Okay. I mean, did you find it kind of a little jarring, the fact that this hasn't got the sort of traditional Muppets humor to it, that this is just a very straightforward story? There's no actual humor in it. It's, as I say, it's just this story told just through the use of puppets.
It may not, see, the whole thing is, and I've never seen a version that had Kermit in it. I saw it as being almost like the sort of archetypal, maybe not necessarily archetypal, but it's like, I saw the essential, it doesn't really matter to me that I don't see the traditional Muppet characters. Kermit and Fozzie, Rolf, and et cetera, aren't there. To me, this is kind of like the thing that, this is to me a kind of like, the essential Hensonness really shines through. You know, this is, I think, in many ways, the thing I'm probably always going to go to, you know, when I think of Henson projects that didn't involve the traditional Muppets, you know, where other people may think Labyrinth or Dark Crystal or Fraggle Rock or whatever. This is, I think, what I'm always going to go to. There is just something about it. You could completely recast these voices with different, you know, it's not the fact that I'm listening to the, you know, the voices, and I can obviously, there's Jerry Nelson, there's Dave Geltz, there's Jim Henson. It's not even necessarily just that. It's just, this is what Henson as a studio was for. And this was, if I recall correctly, this was like, I think the first big thing that they did without the traditional Muppets that really kind of hit big, kind of like in the consciousness. The other main thing that they had tried to do before this was they had tried to do more kind of like adult-oriented humor in the early days of the first season of Saturday Night Live. And a lot of that failed because it was not the Henson crew itself that was providing the writing. It was the SNL team and the head writer. And as much as I've always respected Michael O'Donohue, who was one of the early head writers of SNL, one of the people that they had poached from National Lampoon. And to me, you know, he is one of the top American comedic geniuses of the late 20th century. But it was very, I mean, Michael O'Donohue did not disguise his contempt at having to write for puppets. He would bitch to people and say, "I don't write for felt," you know. And I think that was kind of the reason Land of Gorch didn't, you know, catch on. Which is kind of sad, because SNL, the early SNL, was the kind of showcase, should have been the kind of ideal showcase for something like that.
Okay.
You know, it's SNL is an institution nowadays, and I'll get off this tangent in a second. SNL is an institution nowadays. People don't remember just how jarring and anarchistic and subversive it was back in the mid 70s.
Yeah.
But you know, this is like, there is just an essential Henson-ness. You know, even the puppets don't display a lot of the catfish does and the snake does, and that's about it. They, you know, have your traditional Muppet look with the ping pong ball eyes. But to me, like I said, this is what Jim Henson Studio, this is the sort of thing they did best, even if it didn't have Kermit in it.
Oh, yeah. It's even though you don't have any of the major Muppets being featured, I mean, a lot of the puppets from this production would obviously turn up in things such as like the Muppet Movie and the Muppet Show. I mean, if you look at the Rainbow Connection finale at the end of the Muppet Movie, you can see Chuck Stoat, Howard Snake, and Old Lady Possum as part of the cameos there. So they did obviously reuse some of these puppets, and they kind of molded them into with the same sort of Muppet sort of like cast. Even though they never became like major players, they were just sort of like bit puppets that were there. But yeah, there's something about this. I mean, I love just the the smaller details, even outside of what the puppets are doing, like when they're rowing the boat, or when you've got the Nightmare Band and they're like going along on the jet skis and the snowmobiles. Just those little details of how they did that. I found those really sort of fascinating. I mean,
yeah, particularly when you can notice that at various points when they're doing the marionette work. But it just has all these charming little details. I mean, one thing I noticed on the second viewing, at the beginning when they're rowing down the river, they're sharing the river with real ducks. And I had never known, you've got ducks in there. And I was like, for some reason, that just struck me, that's so cool. That they had trained ducks for this. That was just amazing, I thought.
I mean, this isn't perhaps my favorite Muppet release. I mean, I watched this. I watched this with my youngest, and because we were watching it on YouTube, and it went straight into the Muppets Christmas Special. And again, it was just seeing the two side by side and stuff. And while I obviously prefer the Christmas Special, which obviously brought in like Fraggle Rock and Sesame Street, as well as the main Muppets there. It was interesting to see Henson's two styles of working. And as I said, it brought back memories of watching The Storyteller. And you forget that he was more than just like a comedy puppets guy. That
right.
He actually saw doing puppets as a way of telling many different stories. And you only even look at like the likes of Labyrinth and Dark Crystal in particular, and how dark that is for a kids movie.
Right.
I mean, there's certainly dark elements within this. I mean, we're talking about these two characters surviving essentially in the puppet version of the Depression.
Right.
Basically struggling to make things through. I mean, this really beats these characters down until you get that sort of like final lift at the end. So it ends on a happy note, but and to that point, it's all like everything's just been piled on one thing after the other to these two characters. And you can't help but wonder when they're going to get a break. It doesn't have this sort of smoltz that perhaps like a more modern like kids production would have, that, you know, everything's so positive, even though we got no money and we got no washtub. And here it's sort of like, you know, these characters go right down to their darkest moment before we're like, suddenly pull back. And as you said, it's, you know, getting a job. This isn't about getting a simple big break. This is about you're gonna do this thing and it's gonna open this door so you can get a job and support yourself like steadily, rather than just have like this burst of income. So
To me, it's you nailed it very early on. It's wholesome with a minimum of schmaltz and cheapness. Mm. You know, at the very end, you know, well, towards the very end, after they lose the contest, you know, Ma and Emmett are talking about how they should feel bad, but they really don't. And to me, that kind of, you know, again, it's really earned it by that point. It's not a cheap moment. They've really earned it.
I mean, on that note, we're going to take a quick break. When we return, though, we're going to be venturing off to a galaxy far, far away and a time long, long ago as we look at the Star Wars Holiday Special.
All right, Kristen, I am so excited that you've decided to do a podcast with me, but what are we going to do a podcast about? There's so many other movie podcasts. We got to do something original.
Well, you know, I'm a big fan of Disney movies. What about something like that?
That's just kids stuff. What do we want to do that for?
Did you know that The Avengers is a Disney movie? Or that Pulp Fiction is a Disney movie?
Pulp Fiction is not a Disney movie.
It's technically owned by Miramax, which is part of Disney.
We are still going to talk about the Disney animated movies, though, right?
I thought you said that was kids stuff.
Well, you know, I've got two kids. I got to be a good dad and stuff.
So be sure to subscribe to the Walt Disney Podcast, where we discuss the various subsidiaries of the Walt Disney Studios, including the animated movies.
It's available on iTunes, Podomatic, and wherever you find great podcasts. And I swear, it's not kid stuff.
And we're back. You're obviously still listening to TV Good Sleep Bad. I'm Elwood Jones, and joining me as always is my co-host, Mr. Daniel Lackey.
Am I itchy to your lumpy, or are you lumpy to my itchy? I'm never sure.
It's, yeah, if you've not guessed already, we're going to be going into the Star Wars Holiday Special. This is probably one of the biggest missteps in the Star Wars franchise, which is really saying a lot when you look at things such as, like, Battle for Endor and Caravan of Hope. The fact that the Ewoks were brought in to replace the Wookiee tribe intended for Return of the Jedi. Or basically anything that happened in episodes 1 and 2. This is still considered the ultimate low point for the series. And as we mentioned already, on Glee, they had the balls to actually proclaim it. There's, and this is the line I love, that every Star Wars fan knows that the Star Wars Holiday Special was one of the greatest Star Wars moments ever, reminding us once again that certain writers don't know what the hell they're doing. But for those not familiar with the 1978 Star Wars Holiday Special, this was a one-off event that was basically saw all the Star Wars cast being reunited for this special. And it falls between Star Wars A New Hope and Empire Strikes Back. And it's basically set around Han Solo and Chewie. They're trying to get back to Krashnik, also referred to as Kazook, where Chewbacca and his family are preparing to celebrate Life Day, which is this big important holiday to Wookiees, or so we're told. And here we're obviously introduced to the three members of Chewbacca's family, his father Itchy, his wife Mala, and his questionable son Lumpy. And along the way, we receive cameos from both Luke Skywalker, Princess Leia, C-3PO, R2-D2, Darth Vader. And we also get the very first introduction of the bounty hunter Boba Fett. This is being a special, also features a number of random celebrity cameos, including Bea Arthur and David Prowse and Harvey Korman. So I do not even know where to start with this car crash of a special, because this is one of those specials that even if we tell you how bad it is, it still doesn't truly justify how horribly bad this special is. But Lucky, I mean, what's your opening tirade on this one?
My opening thing is that if you look at the idea of look at the people that wrote this. Okay, one of the things is that a lot of people kind of, I guess, don't realize was that this was done at a kind of a point when Lucasfilm did not have the sort of iron fist of Stalin over, did not kind of exercise that kind of iron fist of Stalin over things that would be branded Star Wars that they eventually took. And that much of it, admittedly, was probably because of this, you know, this is, I can imagine George Lucas after this comes out saying, yeah, okay, we need to tighten up the quality control on this because we can't have this shit again. The writers for this include Pat Proft, who went on to write, I think maybe possibly even co-create Police Squad and contribute to Zucker Abraham's Zucker movies. And another writer on this is Bruce Valanche, who Americans probably only know as the middle square in the 90s version of Hollywood Squares. He's basically this very, very camp joke writer. He's one of the team that the Oscars tends to write the jokes for the Oscars. Or he was at one point. I don't know if he still is. You know, and that's the thing. It's like, The thing that I generally started to sink in was that I felt we were dealing with people who hadn't. I would be surprised to find out that any of these writers had actually even watched Star Wars, let alone, you know, knew what it would be, what is something that you would label a Star Wars holiday special should be. I mean, you start off talking about, And I wanted to interrupt you, but you start off talking about Han Solo and Chewbacca trying to get back to Kashyyyk for Life Day, which makes it sound like it's actually going to be more exciting than it is, because, you know, Harrison Ford and Peter Mayhew are in it for all about maybe 10 minutes. 10 minutes out of an hour and 37 minutes. 90% of this freaking thing is just watching Itchy, Lumpy, and Mala wander around what it looks to be a 1977 suburban household with the occasional, you know, touch of something to look kind of science fiction-y, you know? And it's just them going around and just doing, milling about like a bunch of idiots. It's like, you know, it's like, what makes Star Wars work? What makes Star Wars work? It's the mysticism, you know, it's the mysticism, and it's the daring do, the swashbuckling, the action, you know, I mean, you're sitting around watching three Wookiees, like, cook dinner. I mean, like, no dialogue for 10 minutes straight. It's just people making Wookiee vocalizations, and not very good ones. There are points where Lumpy sounds like a car that won't start in negative 15 degree Fahrenheit weather. That's what Lumpy fucking sounds like, you know? it's like, here's the scene where Mala's trying to make dinner, and she's watching Harvey Korman, you know, play a four-armed alien on television, you know? And then, you know, Art Carney shows up, and he's at he has this little insert where he's this traitor who trades with the Wookiees, and this Imperial guy with this epic mustache comes in, and he's Art Carney, bless Art Carney, but it was just like, I don't even think Art Carney understood what the hell he was doing in this thing. You know, he's sitting here, he's trying to do this sort of, trying to play this kind of like weird sort of, I don't know what the hell he's trying to do, but he's trying to sell this little miniature aquarium to this Imperial officer who gets the best line of the entire thing. I hate fish. You know, and it's like, you know, it's like at least Hayden Christensen, when he said, I hate sand, it gets in everything. I mean, at least you kind of got this idea that Hayden Christensen might have been acting, but it's like, I hate fish.
I just want to focus really on Chewbacca's family, first of all. So we got his father, Itchy, who basically looks like a squash version of Toby Jones, but hairier.
Good Lord, you're right. I kept thinking it was like, I swear to God, I thought it was more like, if you remember RoboCop and you remember that big vat of like toxic goo that okay. The guy got dropped in. Yeah. I thought that if you took the gremlin from Twilight Zone Nightmare at 20,000 Feet, the original episode with William Shatner, you took the gremlin and took him into RoboCop and dumped him in that vat, took him out, he'd look like Itchy. He'd look like fucking Itchy. I swear. I think it's like, what is this? Is that even a Wookiee? What is that thing?
We've got Chewbacca's wife, Malia, who, according to Peter Mayhew, was played by a guy who was about 300 pounds, which is another interesting, really says a lot to his credit as an actor. And then we got his retarded son, Lumpy, who just looks confused all the time. And yeah, as you said, we get to see them do such exciting things, such as watching Malia attempt to cook along to some bizarre cooking show, which obviously goes wrong, and hilarity is supposed to ensue there. We get to see Itchy watch the virtual reality sex program with Diane Carroll, which you're basically seeing a Wookiee get off on watching futuristic porn. In the
holiday special, kid. VR is like prototype VR porn for Wookiees.
Yeah.
Only in the Star Wars holiday special.
Yeah, he's all about Life Day. He's celebrating life by defiling the family lounge. And as I said, we've got Lumpy, who's basically amused. He's fascinated by everything. And there's a scene where he's watching this cartoon show because we get a cartoon interlude which introduces Boba Fett. But the cartoon, I don't know who designed this cartoon, but it's like, if you look at the Indonesian posters for any action movie, it's basically the same. Whoever does those posters obviously designed this cartoon, because Han Solo looks like Mick Jagger.
I thought he looked more like Roger Waters, to be honest.
That works as well. Chewbacca is kind of like got a very small face. They've like shrunk Chewbacca's face down to like a pinhead and still got the same size head. It's like the most bizarre. It's the most bizarre like representation. And the fact that Millennium Falcon has fuzzy dice.
Oh god. Go on.
This is the highlight of this 19. Well, how long does this go on for? I mean, this is, it felt like
it goes on for an hour and 37 minutes. I counted.
This is the highlight, and this is only the halfway point. It should be.
I want to kind of point also out. Also, I watched an episode of a show about a guy watching a YouTube series about a guy watching bad movies. Following this up, it was a thing that came on YouTube after this. And his response to the cartoon was epic. He's like, is this Luke Skywalker or is this Willem Dafoe?
Yeah, so,
And this was Nelvana. This was a Nelvana animation production. And it literally looks, there are points at which this looks worse than Heavy Metal. The Heavy Metal.
And it's,
the thing about this is, again, the whole thing that makes me wonder if anybody involved in the creation of this had actually ever seen Star Wars is the bit that, and this is the thing that had me laughing the hardest. There is a bit early on in the cartoon where Luke Skywalker actually doesn't understand what R2-D2 is saying and has to have C-3PO translate.
Yeah, I mean, how exciting was it, though, to see early Boba Fett?
It was actually pretty cool. That was pretty cool. I will give it that.
Yeah, because, I mean, Boba Fett at this point, we don't obviously get to see Boba Fett until Empire Strikes Back in the film. So this was actually the first appearance of Boba Fett. And, he's still as cool as he is in the films. And obviously Boba Fett's become, like, this big cult icon within like the Star Wars universe, so to see him introduced in this way was really kind of exciting. The other part I got excited about, which I don't think anyone else did, is the fact that you get a cameo by Jefferson's starship.
Jefferson's starship.
Because, I like Jefferson Airplane. Obviously, Jefferson Airplane turned to Jefferson Starship and then to Starship. And they turn up in Marley's music box when we obviously get the whole of the Empire, which totals about 4 stormtroopers in this production, show up and start rooting through her stuff. We have all these like little asides, and we get to go to Mos Eisley Bar, and you're thinking, oh great, we're going to get the Cantina Band, and they're going to play that like one song that they know.
Admittedly, they do.
But we also get B. Arthur doing some weird warbling version of Good Night, but not Goodbye. Was that set to the Cantina Band theme?
That was set to the Cantina Band theme.
Oh my god. Because I kind of recognized the music in the background, but I was too distracted by her warbling away. Because whenever you have a musical song in it, it's not a fun song. It's like...
Hey! I want to point this out here. I'm looking at the Wikipedia article for the holiday special right now, and I'm reading this here. When the Empire announces the curfew, Admina, who is played by B. Arthur, announces a last drink, and when the creatures ignore her, she sings a fun song. They describe this as a fun song.
It should be noted that if you have a musical moment, it's more than likely going to be them putting words on something that already exists on the soundtrack. So by the time we get to the end of this, and we obviously get to see Chewbacca and his family walk into the sun while wearing red robes. They've not cared about wearing clothes until Life Day celebration comes around for whatever reason. and we get Carrie Fisher singing about Life Day to the Star Wars theme tune.
And am I the only person who watched this sequence and thought to myself, they look like they're the people who are going to die, going off to die at the beginning of Logan's Run because they're about to turn 30?
That could be rather true. God, you're just making me think of that whole opening sequence of Logan's Run now. But yeah, they're basically,
yeah.
Thanks to some questionable blue screen, we have Chewbacca and his family walk into the sun.
Yes.
Which may explain why we never saw Chewbacca's family again after this.
They did show up in the novels.
Yeah, but
And supposedly Lucas has said that somewhere in the Battle of Kashyyyk, in Revenge of the Sith, somewhere, nobody's really entirely sure whether we actually see him or not, but Itchy is in there somewhere.
Oh, God. I mean, why was this the story?
I don't know.
There were so many different options. They could have done like a fun, like adventure story with these characters, but no, instead we're having this bloody slice of life drama in the Wookiee household. Oh,
my God. You see, drama, you call it a drama, and drama makes it sound like things happen. And they don't. I mean, it's like, it's this bizarre sort of thing where you see what they were trying to do. They were trying to basically make a Star Wars variety show with celebrities. Here's Jefferson Starship. Here's Diane Carroll. Here's B. Arthur. Here's a guy whose name you might know because he's in Mel Brooks movies. Here's, you know, Art Carney again. You know, it's like it had all these people, like these celebrities in it, you know, but it's like they had no freaking context for what people would actually want out of a Star Wars Star Wars Day special. And it's sort of like, let's just have like an average day in like the let's just have an average day, you know, in the life of a Wookiee. And ultimately, you know, it's there. I understand there is just so much wrong with this that it's you really have to, again, it just shows that I'm only half-heartedly criticizing the people for make this. It doesn't look like Star Wars. None of the original elements to this production look like they belong in the Star Wars universe. There's this scene early, I mean, I can understand certain cheap things. It's a TV special. You've blown your entire budget. Okay, you've blown your entire, like, half your budget just getting enough cocaine to induce the members of Jefferson Starship to show up on it, okay? I mean, because at that point, I assume Paul Kantner and Marty Balin, I'm assuming epic amount of cocaine was going up their nose. But, I mean, so I understand that it's not going to be as polished as the film. So I can understand certain things, like the little holographic thing that they have towards the beginning is obviously a freaking tape player, you know. But it's like, and then when they do a little Cirque du Soleil thing, which in theory is not actually a bad idea. I mean, it's another little bit of world building, which in theory is one of the things that the film Star Wars as a film did so well. But none of the design looks even remotely like anything that would have been in Star Wars, you know. So I'm willing to forgive certain things because of, you know, production values. I'm willing to forgive that there's a scene early on in the special where Lumpy goes outside, looks over the balcony of his home, and looks down into what looks like a blown up panel from the Marvel Star Wars comic book. I mean, there are matte paintings and there is this. This does not look, this, I swear to God, it looks like John Buscema, you know, drew it, or whoever was doing the art for that thing at the time. Jack Kirby, I don't know. I can forgive stuff like that. It's just that none of the concepts just seem like they belong. You know, it's like the Wookiees don't look like Wookiees. They look like, horrible mutated things.
Yeah.
I can forgive certain things. Like, I'll give the bizarre design of the Nelvana cartoon, because at least it has a somewhat interesting story. And apart from the fact that you expect Han Solo to grab a bass guitar and start singing "Wish You Were Here" at any moment, it actually kind of looks good. From a design standpoint, very, very patchy animation. I particularly liked how R2-D2 seemed to be made of rubber or something, because his dimensions were always changing, but at least there was at least it had some interesting designs, some interesting concepts. Boba Fett's genuinely cool. I love the guy. I love the voice they gave him, Don Franks. And it had a story that was actually halfway engaging. And then they cut from that to just a bunch of people. You have a situation late in the game where you have this, you have Chewbacca's family, in theory, under threat from the Imperials. And it has all the drama and tension. It has all the drama and tension of a bunch of people standing up, of a bunch of teenagers standing in the back of the school during smoking period. It's just, it's dull. That's the thing about it, is that it's, to me, it's so dull. Even the points when it, even the points when it says, even the bad points, even like the whole, the mind-bendingly bad, how could they even have thought that, getting B. Arthur to sing a song to the tune of the Cantina theme was a good idea. The point is, she spends, that wears off in about 30 minutes. She spends 5 minutes singing it. And doing this stupid thing where she's trying to get people out of the cantina and it's not working. That's the thing. Every gag in this special is drawn out to the point of tediousness. B. Arthur has this thing where she's trying to fend off the amorous advances of Harvey Korman, who for some reason has like four roles in this damn thing. And it's just, it's too long. Jefferson Starship goes off and plays a 6-minute tune. There's a 3-minute, there's a 3-minute long intro to the Diane Carroll bit. And it's lazy ideas of what futuristic prog rock would sound like. It's like, we'll just put a flanger on everything. And it'll sound like Pink Floyd for 3 minutes, and it doesn't. It sounds like some idiot noodling with too many pedals. It's just like everything goes on for at least 5 minutes longer than it should. That's just my problem with it. It's dull. If you go through a synopsis of it, you could cut about half of it down, and it would still be bad. You would still make fun of it, but it would still have this sort of camp element to it that you could understand why people would feel kind of like that it was the ugly baby, it's the sort of love that you were charging that is reserved for like an ugly baby that only has one withered limb, but it's still love, whereas with this, I can't imagine anybody wanting to watch this a second time, other than to either have to comment on it, or because they were dared. You watch it once, and I think you're done with it. You put it aside. I can't imagine somebody wanting to sit through, 10 minutes of Wookiees arguing with each other.
That's
no
true.
Subtitles. It's just like, rawr, for like 10 minutes.
Yeah.
It's,
I think, some other little interesting tidbits, really. The fact that you mentioned already about R2-D2 not looking like he does in the films. This is the fact that Kenny Baker wasn't involved in the production at all. R2 in this special is just a remote-controlled unit. And most interestingly,
Who operated it?
He's Mick Garris, the director of Critters 2 and the creator of The Master of Horror. He was Lucas's receptionist. That's how he got the gig on this one.
And the hilarious thing I saw at the end, makeup effects by Rick Baker and Stan Winston.
Oh, yeah. This is like when you watch Flesh Gordon and you see the guys who worked on this also worked on Star Wars.
Yeah.
I love the fact that Ms. Garris doesn't even get a credit. R2-D2 is credited as playing himself.
Yeah.
And of this I mean, this special was only shown once, and this is a real credit to the world of tape trading and the fact that it's had this life on afterwards, because the only part that's been re-released in any format was the cartoon segment, the Boba Fett cartoon, and that you can find as an Easter egg on the 2011 Star Wars Complete Saga Blu-ray set. But that's it. They've no plans to ever release it. As far as Lucas is concerned, it never existed. Everyone's basically distanced themselves from it. Carrie Fisher, however, in agreement for doing the commentary for the Star Wars disc, actually had Lucas give her a copy of this on DVD or Blu-ray or whatever. And she's actually been noted as saying she shows it at parties. So
usually when she wants to get rid of people.
Yeah, so
usually the end of a party when she's trying to clear the house out.
It's like you've had your free party. I'm putting the tape on.
Okay, here. I mean, there are even points when Mark Hamill can't even believe he's been called upon to do this. It's it's Chewbacca. Put him on. You know, and it's just like. And what is up with the eyeliner he was wearing on this? Or did he always have eyeliner and I never noticed? I don't know,
because I'm trying to remember if this is like pre or post car crash for Mark Hamill as well.
Yeah, I don't know.
Because he had to have like a surgery because of the car crashes of old, and that's why the Wampa scene was written into Empire Strikes Back to account for his scars on his face. Uh-huh. And I can't remember if this was pre or post post car crash for him, and I'm sure that someone will post.
I would have to think it's pre. He just looks, if nothing else, he just looks so young and baby faced and like kind of like Leif Garrett in it. But yeah, that's something I'll have to look up. I don't know when he had that car crash.
Let's go.
But I have to think it was after this. For me, it's just, it could be. I mean, it just could be like a side effect of the fact that it's, you know, any version of this that you're going to see nowadays obviously is going to have all the hallmarks of having been ripped from videotape.
Yeah.
You know, so it's going to have, you know, that certain sort of weird feeling, that sort of weird sort of distortion that you get from, that you would get from taping things off of the air. Although, even then, it still looks like it was also simply made very, very cheaply.
Is there anything else that you want to tear off this one?
God, I think I've pretty much ripped up everything I can about this. It's just,
yeah.
You know, I think to be honest, I think this is the second time I've seen this. You know, about 16, 17 years ago, you know, when I first moved out and was living on my own with a roommate, and he had been to a convention, and there was a bootleg DVD. He had bought a bootleg of this, and he showed it to me on DVD. And the fun thing about that was it still had the original commercials with it.
Oh, yeah.
This was aired on CBS, which the version I watched on YouTube does not have. And I remember thinking at the time that other than Boba Fett, having those little clips of commercials were easily the best thing about this.
It's always great to see what people were shopping for at the time and seeing those actual toy commercials. But no, I think in conclusion, this is a special that I think you have to watch once. I'm kind of ashamed that this is like my third time I've seen this now. It doesn't get any better. I'll tell you that much. Repeat viewing.
I'll say these things about it. For better or worse, it's part of Star Wars lore. It's part of the shared culture. It's like in Doctor Who fans, you know, this is the equivalent of dimensions in time. You know, or the entire Trial of a Time Lord. Well, you know, season, except for the interesting bits that had, you know, because at least there were four interesting episodes of Trial of a Time Lord that had Brian Blessed in it. But, you know, this is just, it's one of those things that I do think if you're a Star Wars fan, you do need to watch something like this or Battle for Endor, you know, to give yourself, I think, a bit of a grounding, you know, for what Star Wars has been over the years. I mean, there's more to Star Wars, even in the visual sense, apart from the comic books, apart from the novels. You know, there's more to Star Wars, obviously, than just, you know, the movies, you know, and the bits of television that we choose to regard highly, the Clone Wars series or Rebels or whatever, you know. There's this, and I think, you know, I think it is the genuine low point of Star Wars. I haven't seen the Ewoks. I haven't seen the Ewoks movies. I haven't seen the Droids cartoon, at least since I was a kid. So but to me, this is like, you know, when you find yourself really getting really highfalutin over Star Wars, just put this thing in. Just put this thing in and then watch Harvey Korman flirt with Bea Arthur, you know, or watch a misshapen mutant, somebody's idea of what a misshapen mutant Wookiee looks like, getting off on Diane Carroll, you know, doing her sex kitten voice. I mean, this is, you know, it's a thing that exists, and it's like I said, it's for better or for worse, it's there, and it's, you know, it's part of the thing that we all love about. It's part of the whole Star Wars thing. We may hate it, but it's there, and we have to cope with it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, on that note, it brings us to the end of another edition of TV Good Sleep Bad. We hope you've enjoyed this festive look back at both Emmett Otter's Jug Band Christmas as well as the Star Wars Holiday Special. This obviously is now our break. Now we'll be back in the new year for a new season of cult TV goodness. But Lucky, I mean, what are you obviously going to be bringing to the table for the next episode?
You know, I had not actually put a whole lot of thought into it beforehand, because we did the recording kind of rapidly, the last few episodes kind of in rapid succession. And I knew kind of going into the end of the year, like I knew that I wanted to do Black Mirror and I knew I wanted to do Emmett Otter. And I really never thought to myself, okay, what do I want to do in January? I didn't really put a lot of thought in it. So I'm just going to have to pull something out of my butt right now. So we're going to do an episode of Gerry Anderson's UFO.
Oh,
I haven't decided which one, but we're going to do UFO because that's on Hulu.
Very nice.
More time Hulu by me. You can probably find it on YouTube. But I will contact you privately, obviously, when I decide on the episode. The one that I always want to do is Mindbender, but I don't know if that one would translate really well. Mindbender is kind of like the UFO equivalent of Jose Chung.
Okay.
It's the one where they kidnap the head of Shadow. They kidnap the lead character. The aliens kidnap the lead character, and they convince him that he's an actor on a TV show about alien invasion.
Oh, nice.
Actually, so I'm sorry. So it's not so much more like, it's not so much like Jose Chung. It's more like that. I think it was an episode of Eerie Indiana.
Yeah.
But anyway, that particular episode of UFO, and I'm not saying we're doing it. I'm just saying it's the one where everybody goes around calling each other by their actors' names. So it's like the sort of weird meta thing, but in like 1970. But we might not do that episode, but we are doing UFO.
So we're going to, obviously, for yourself, we're going to be doing UFO. For myself, we're going to be looking at the pilot episode of Brian Fuller's Dead Like Me. This is a show which only had two seasons, and it basically gave us Ellen Mumph, who is a wonderful little indie actress. And basically, for those not familiar with the show, she here plays Georgina Lass, or George, who is basically 18 years old. She's a college dropout, and she's been forced to go and get a job at Happy Time Temporary Services. However, on her first lunch break from there, she manages to get killed by a toilet seat from the deorbiting Mir space station, only to then find herself reincarnated as a Grim Reaper. She finds herself taken in by the local Grim Reaper sect to deal with the accidents side of things, led by Mandy Patinkin's Rube. And over the course of the series, she is required to help people pass over. This is a show which is wonderfully blackly comedic, and sadly, while it obviously had its cult following, it never really got its full run, I felt. It certainly had an ending after its two seasons. I felt that it always was kind of left wanting a little more from this series. So it's going to be interesting, and obviously we're going to be looking at the pilot episode, which essentially sets up this whole world that Brian Fuller creates in this world of Gravelings and Grim Reapers, and where accidental death is perhaps a little more orchestrated than it may seem. But certainly that's my choice.
Interesting thing. I read somewhere that there is a fan theory about Hannibal, the TV show Hannibal, which was also created and run by Brian Fuller, that the first season is actually an alternate universe version of Dead Like Me. Particularly considering the fact that Ellen Muth is in also stars in an arc towards the end of the first season as a woman named Georgina Lass, who suffers from, I believe it's the Capgras delusion, which is that she believes she's dead.
That would be like a perfect tie-in, obviously, between the two series.
I never having had seen Dead Like Me, that this was actually my introduction to Brian Fuller as a showrunner was Hannibal. Although I was aware of, like, he had done some stuff for the first season. He had basically written the episodes of Heroes that still, the first season of Heroes that still hold up.
Okay.
But I read that later, and it's like, huh, one of these days I'll actually have to get around to Dead Like Me. So this is going to be really interesting.
So, there was our selections. We'll obviously in the next episode, we'll look at UFO and Dead Like Me. As always, though, you can keep up with everything that's happening on the show via our Facebook page, which is TV Good Sleep Bad. If you enjoyed the show or want to leave us some comments, please do. On either Podomatic or iTunes, wherever you happen to be listening to us. You know, leave us a rating, leave us some comments, let us know what you think of the show. Also, we also love to hear any recommendations of shows you would love to see us to cover on the show. So again, let us know if you're on the Facebook page, and we can certainly try and get round to watching them. But until next time, I've been Edward Jones, and thank you again to my co-host, Mr. Daniel Lackey.
Thank you.
And
thank you.
And this is us signing off another edition of TV Good Sleep Bad, wishing you all a very Merry Christmas.